This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Welcome to another episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am not the eponymous Hour. I am John Bruford, one of your hosts, joined by your other host, Dr. Michael Hour. Hello, Dr. Hour.
Hey, is there a third one? Or because you said you're one of the hosts.
Yeah, but there's two of us. Like, I'm the other one.
Okay.
That's the plural. I know English isn't your first language, but geez, come on, dude. My God.
I'm pretending, you know.
You can't pretend idiocy. You're here as a doctor.
Just want to sound cool.
There's nothing cool about being stupid, Dr. Al. You're demeaning your doctorate.
Well, you always have to have a skill, you know. Don't go full retard.
Oh, God, yeah. I love that. I love that movie so much. I love that movie so much. And would it even get made now? I'm actually not sure. It was so sly in the way that it criticized everything it criticized that I don't know that it would get made now.
Rewatch it tonight. Thank you.
That's a good call. I might do the same. But I wonder if our guest will be watching Tropic Thunder this evening. I honestly don't know. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by, I didn't find out any of his titles. I bet he's got loads of titles. But we're joined by Kazrat Gaharian. I probably fucked that up. Director of Research at the International Gaming Institute at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Kazra, welcome. What cool titles have you got? Are you like a doctor professor?
I have a PhD. So technically I'm a doctor, I guess, but I don't flaunt it around like Michael does. But yeah.
he starts with the low blow. Okay.
Low but fair.
But this is okay. UFC without rules, okay? I get it.
Yeah.
Sure. Of course there aren't any rules. So, but it's just a doctorate, is it? You're not a professor or anything?
No.
Are you insulting us here now? I told you 100 times before, professor means nothing, okay? Nothing.
Yeah, you said that until we had Professor Sally Gainsbury on, and then you're like, no, being a professor is awesome.
Okay, let's, you know, edit this out.
No, you know how the editing works. Everything stays.
Yeah, because you're too lazy to do it.
It's not laziness as such. I like to say it's because we favor a long-form podcast. And that enables my laziness.
I left a drink of tea spiked with a bit of rum from my AC/DC mug now, too.
It's a shame that we're not recording video, really, isn't it?
I was going to ask if you guys did video. It would be...
I would have sort of, you know, made myself up a little bit more.
Yeah, me too. I would have worn something without food stains on, which counts as dressing up where I'm from. So,
never wear pants, but let's not get into that, you know.
But you say that like it's a bad thing. Kazra, I can't help but notice that you don't have a Nevada accent.
No.
You are, I believe, British born.
Correct, yeah.
And I obviously I know the answer to this because I asked you before we started recording, but where are you from and what was it UNLV that took you to Vegas? Tell us how your adventure began.
Yeah, no, I'll do a little bit of a brief background. Born in London, spent first, I think like 12 or 13 years of my life. We were in Roehampton and Putney, moved to Surrey, Epsom and Ewell in, you know, when I was 13. So I did high school and stuff in Kingston. And then, you know, went to university for my bachelor's degree. I studied business management at the University of Surrey in Guildford. So not too far from where I was living. And so this is going to come to why I moved to Vegas. So at the University of Surrey, it was about the time where online poker was getting really popular, you know, around the time of Chris Moneymaker and the World Series and that kind of thing. So I set up the University of Surrey Poker Society. So we held like a multi-table tournament every Sunday in one of the lecture halls there. I think we started with like 10 people, soon got to like, you know, 10 tables. So about 100 people were coming every Sunday.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really fun. We also had a cash game in one of the dormitory kitchens as well, midweek, which got a bit spicy. But yeah, got into poker. I was playing online a little bit. Me and my friend did okay for ourselves. So we actually came out to Vegas a couple of times to play poker. I didn't want to be a professional poker player, but I was really kind of, I really loved the Vegas resorts, the integrated resorts and the casinos, and I thought it would be really cool to work at one of them. So found out about UNLV, applied, came here for grad school, and yeah, met my wife, got a job. Rest is history.
Wow.
Awesome. I never knew that.
Yeah.
What about your twin brother? Is he still there too? The guy who pretty much looks like you, just a bit younger.
Which one is that?
Yeah, you know the guy like who is always around when we met. Like,
Sorry, yeah, Mana. Yeah, he's exactly. So I supervise him for my PhD. It's because he's So my mum is from the Midlands, as I was telling you, John, before. My dad's actually Iranian. So Mana, who Michael's referring to, he's also, his mum is white and his dad is Persian. So he's got like the similar mix to me. And yeah, we look kind of similar, I guess.
Yeah. How crazy.
Totally. I mean, when we go to your to the UNLV conference in May, Mana will be there, right?
Yeah. I think he's got some stuff he's going to submit. He's doing a lot of work now on, he's doing some consulting with a lot of like Asian casinos. So he's doing a lot of like table game stuff, like baccarat analysis and things like that. So should be presenting something interesting, I hope, hopefully you're going to be presenting, Michael, I guess.
Yeah, I submitted 3 abstracts the other day.
Michael. Great.
I'm also hoping to be delivering a keynote speech.
Yeah.
Do you scoff, co-host?
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
Well, hang on a second. Are you telling me that somebody without a doctorate or any of that shit would not be able to give a keynote there? Because I reckon I can rock this.
I think you could. Yeah.
What would your keynote be on? What would be the topic?
Interestingly,
don't entertain him.
I was thinking about this the other day.
Enable him.
I was thinking about this the other day. Right. My keynote would be about, possibly a combination of things, possibly the need for a national framework within the US that RG could provide as a baseline for all states, but also the feasibility of player protection until the profitability of player protection is proven.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I've always thought about... you know, you always hear people about saying like, oh, yeah, RG is good for business. It's a good business strategy because we want long-term players. But I've never actually seen any kind of like hard data, whether that's like a actual business model.
But how would you do it, you know? It's something that, you know, I've been thinking about a lot and you too, you discussed it before. What's the ultimate goal here, you know? I mean, like, okay, we can, you know, jump right into the topic of predicting problem gambling. Can we standardize this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But what's actually, what are we trying to achieve here, you know? Are we trying to identify those who are PGSI? positive.
Can I answer your question, even though I'm not the guest? People that are listening right now are like, fuck, I wish this guy had shut up. I think part of the issue is, and I appreciate it, I'm in exactly the right place for you two to tell me I'm wrong. I think part of the issue is that sometimes a safety net isn't treated as a safety net. Do you know what I mean? And I think the prediction tools, the sort of problem alerting tools, the ones that say this dude's out of control, that should be the last thing that's encountered. Absolutely. And all of the tools that are available should be just there and running all the time so that the player never gets to the safety net.
Yeah, I mean, I always use this analogy, like, you know, when you identify somebody as a potential problem gambler, they have fallen off the cliff, right? So they have overspent. And I would say this is almost, you know, the easiest, you know, exercise analytically here to identify somebody who might have overdone it. But what we actually want to achieve is we want to create a stable environment where, you know, players don't run into the issue. And that then also goes in line with what, you know, Cass, you said before about, you know, about loyalty, about, you know, player lifetime and so on and so forth. But I would say, especially, you know, in the US online gambling regulation, none of this is actually there, right? I mean, if you look at the regulation there, there are no limits. I mean, operators do not even have to provide players limits. There's no mandatory player feedback. Basically, none of this, you know, prevention stuff is there.
It's probably a function of the market maturity, though, right? The US online market's a lot younger than the European market.
But what I'm trying to say is, okay, we focus now, or lots of discussion focuses on the AI, on the prediction, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. When you could actually prevent a lot of problems developing if you did the homework first. But that's something, you know, that's not somehow fancy to talk about. It's more in fashion. And
I was like listening. I was on the way here. I was listening to your guys' podcast with, you had it with, I can't remember her name, from Egba.
Vasily.
And, you know, I was thinking, you know, going back to what John said about the tools and stuff, I'm like, yeah, the tools are good. But, you know, we know uptake is hard and we know it's hard to get people to use a tool. So there's a challenge there. But then, I was thinking myself driving over here. So I just signed with a new car insurance company and I'm doing my, you know, they have an app where they track your driving for the first 3 months, right? And like, I'm just going to open up the app now. So they have like four or five different categories. So it's, so they monitor my braking, my acceleration, my speed, the time of day I drive, and the distraction, if I pick up my phone or anything, right? Mm-hmm. And this is incentivizing me because, you know, if I do good in the first 90 days, they're going to reduce my premium by like 20-30%, which it gives me an incentive to actually do this stuff for like at least 90 days, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's maybe something that could be, I don't know, could there be something like this modeled for the online gambling environment where you're actually providing some incentive to behave well?
That's the question, you know. I mean, like, what I'm you know, I always, I mean, in my head, you know, there's this sort of, you know, thought. So we know that if players deposit frequently, that, you know, that's an indication of impulsivity, of chasing after losses, right? So, you know, somebody deposits $500, they gamble it all away. After an hour, they deposit again, and so on and so forth. Okay, how could an operator could easily actually avoid, you know, promoting this behavior if they only allowed every player to deposit once a day? Okay, so make up your mind, right? You know, you want to gamble today. Okay, make up your mind how much you actually want to deposit and that's it. You know, they might deposit maybe a little bit more, you know, just to be on the safe side, but you could easily prevent the chasing after the losses or the impulsivity, you know, the loss of control. But I never saw anybody, you know, picking up on such an, you know, a restriction or whatever you want to call it, RG tool. You know, lots of the behavior actually that we think, you know, is problematic is actually within, you know, the technology, could technologically be removed.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess going back to the, you know, the car insurance example, I guess it wouldn't even be with this, right? They're not even telling me what to do. They're just saying, we're going to monitor your driving. I could go out there and drive like an idiot. Still, they're not going to tell me not to do that. But if I do that, then I'm going to pay a higher premium.
Yeah.
Now this is a totally different ecosystem and environment to gambling, and the economics are all different. But I'm just, what, there surely is a way to kind of create some kind of similar incentive.
Yeah, incentivization. Fuck, all bonusing is incentivization.
Right.
And so there's no reason that couldn't be, you know, positive.
Using Michael's example of depositing, right? It's pretty clear, like, if you like deplete your account like 5 times in a row within an hour, and then you deposit, you know, £500 or euros, whatever it is, from your bank account, that's reloading your account. That's a pretty bad sign. Could you be penalized in some way for doing that? I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, but, yeah.
Probably like an idea would be to change the RTP, you know, like if you behave that way, okay.
If you behave well, maybe you can access riskier games. I don't know. I don't know what.
If operators are still dead set on, you know, making everything the player's responsibility, then incentivize setting limits, incentivize all of those things. And really easy to do on sign up. Hey, if you do this as well, you get an extra 100 free spins.
Yeah.
I mean, I think operators, you know, think too little about, let's say that, you know, it's entertainment actually, right? And you could, you know, for example, lock certain games, they're just not available, and only if you behave a certain way, you can play certain games.
I guess to play devil's advocate on this, you'd probably get like some selection bias, right? You just get like, I just downloaded this app. I opted into this app because I think I can drive well for 90 days. So you're going to get people that are like, you know what? I'm not going to do this because I just want to drive how I want.
Yeah, but that's always the question, right? So let's say if you study, let's say, limit setting, then you can argue, okay, the players who choose limits and who choose realistic limits, which seem to be somehow relate to their, you know, to their available, funds, they, you know, they are a certain subgroup of the population. And others will never, you know, choose a limit, never behave, you know, responsibly. And whatever you do, you can't make them, you know?
Yeah.
Well, but by nature, gamblers are risk takers, obviously. So but for incentivization...
Humans are risk takers.
Oh, fuck yeah. Although I'm less so now that I've got kids. But for incentivization to work, it has to be something worth losing. It almost has to be something worth winning and then not losing, or something. You know what I mean? You've got to work with that knowledge of risk taking. You've got to work with that knowledge that they are here.
I mean, yeah.
To gamble.
Let's come back, you know, to this analogy that, you know, we discussed before. So when you look at any online gambling operator's data, then what do you find? You find that a small percentage of the players generate a large amount of the profits. Okay, so basically you pick any, you know, large online gambling operator, wherever you are in the world, depending a bit on the regulation, you will see that actually, you know, 10%, 20% of the players are relevant, The rest are just, you know, white noise, basically. Recreation or whatever you want to call it. And
that drives me mad.
What drives me mad?
Well, exactly what you're describing, you know, sort of like the
group, you know?
The iceberg model.
If you look at gambling in total, right, the prevalence of casino gambling, no matter where, is quite low, right? I mean, we're not talking about lottery, you know, scratch cards or weekly, you know, draw games, but actually a very small percent of the population play casino games. An even smaller one play it online, and out of those who do it, an even smaller one like it a lot. And the question is, okay, I mean, can you actually do something about it, you know? I mean, they just like it. They love it, you know? That's their thing. And if they would be sort of, you know, restricted with an operator, would they simply go to another and do it there, you know? It's you know, some, you know, it's, just like with many other, you know, behaviors, you know, you have, we always have a group of the population who are really into it, you know?
Yep.
And the tools gotta be, you know, in a way that it helps them. And not like, because what we often see is, okay, it works, but among who, you know? And if you look at the extremely involved players, does it actually work there? But those are the ones who really need it.
But the reason that I was pissing and moaning a minute ago is, and I know I've said this to you before, Michael, like, and I'm just pulling these numbers out of my ass just as a representative example, but say that 95% of players who represent a relatively small amount of money, but say, for example, we're talking about a sample from, and this is, again, this is out of my ass, but say we're talking about 100 million people. If your business is based on getting 5 million of those 100 million people, those 5 million people are expensive to acquire and they're expensive to keep. But if you have a business that's working with the other 95%, and the only thing you do in your first quarter is you get each of them to spend an extra $1.50 a month, you've had an absolutely extraordinary quarter. And if you can do that four times a year, which is not ridiculous, not by any stretch of the imagination, that's a business. That's how most other businesses are working.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're talking about the difference between a mass market model and a whale model. And Vegas is the epitome of the mass market model, or it was. Back when it gave great value, because it was about the number of people coming through. Because some of those are going to gamble, some of them are going to do shows, some of them are going to do a fancy restaurant.
Yeah.
There's only a very small number of them that are going to do all of those things.
Yeah.
But it's the proof that the mass market.
Yep. Because
kind of works.
Have more, you know, entertainment options, right? There's lots of cross selling between.
When you're pulling those numbers out of your ass, but really, I mean, I know Michael knows this as well. If you look at any kind of gambling data set, you always get that really small proportion of people who are accounting for the large proportion of revenue. We just had we did some analysis. We published two papers with some banking data we have from about a million or so people in the UK. And we did it. I don't think it's in the paper, but we did a quick analysis of like, the distribution of revenue, or, you know, the distribution of deposits for different categories of spending. So we did like gambling, going out to eat, sports products, like whatever it was, right? And that, like, the trend lines for gambling was very distinct. You didn't see this like high proportion of spend to a small proportion of the population in any other kind of spending category.
Yeah, because it's so exotic, no?
Yeah.
I mean, I have this in front of me, so we finished this paper, and sadly, it's too long to be submitted to most of the journals, right? There's really a maximum word count.
Yeah.
And I have this US data set, like 400,000 players or something, and 20% of the players generate 95% of the revenue.
Yeah. We just had that. I think I had that exact same figure in another paper.
Because there's just one other paper by what are they called? They used they had data set also real world player data set from the UKGC. And they came up with similar figures, slightly lower. But what we did, you know, we compare this distribution from the US, Ontario, Germany, UK, Spain, Netherlands. Of course, there it's not as extreme because you have this, you know, limitation, right? In the UK, if somebody loses 10,000, then probably somebody goes to prison. And in Germany, it's 1,000 a month. In the Netherlands, they introduced like €700 monthly deposit limit. So you cannot even lose that much there, you know?
It's possible.
But in the US, if you look in a typical data set, you will see a player who lost 500K, 800K, maybe even a million.
So is your are you saying then that there is maybe legs or so what, I guess, what's your opinion then of kind of this more public health approach where you are kind of mandating these, you know, loss limits and things like these? Do you think they're having an impact and an effect?
I mean, yeah, they definitely have an impact on spend, you know. Of course, yeah, there has to be an impact. The question is, I mean, what's again, like I said before, what am I trying to achieve here, you know?
Yeah.
Because are the players who would have spent more really cut off? Or do they go spend it elsewhere? Or do they, you know, sort of spread their play across operators?
Yeah, that's another question, isn't it?
Or do they go off? So a good example is, okay, so in Sweden, in June 2020, they introduced a weekly deposit limit online. What happened is that the number of registrations went up, right? Because it's not a single customer view. So they don't monitor this across the operators. But the operators saw many more new clients, you know? Of course, what happened, you know? Players who wanted to spend more circumvented this weekly limit simply by playing on multiple platforms.
The
question is, okay, do these some, I mean, there are certainly some players who just, you know, will try to figure out a way to be, you know, to spend more than would actually be allowed. But again, you know, it comes down to what are we trying to achieve? Do we want to sort of, you know, stabilize problem gambling like classic PGSI? Like you said before, do we want to look into public health, like, you know, all the impact of gambling? Thirdly, do I want to increase generalization as a state? Okay, I don't care, you know, but I want to sort of generate the tax revenue and have players gamble with my, you know, regulated operators. You know, I mean, there's no really answer here. But very rarely, I would say, you know, the discussions look beyond those tiny, you know, tiny things.
Yeah.
But for example, you came up with the framework, right, of prediction, etc. And maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. And you know, there is this Spanish case, right? You're aware that the Spanish regulator now said, okay, we're gonna roll out one algorithm
across licensed
operators. I mean, we will sort of, you know, give you the algorithm, like the formula, the secret formula, you know?
Yeah, the
secret formula.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're gonna run it. And it's an interesting approach. And
you
put a lot of thought into how, you know, algorithms could actually be validated, compared, certified, whatever.
Yeah, it's been kind of a bit of a passion project for me the, you know, past few years. This whole algorithmic risk detection space is very interesting.
It is.
I love, you know, going back, we'll talk about the benchmarking paper that we just wrote in a bit, but yeah, I mean, even going coming before algorithms, right, is the kind of markers of harm. Like, what are you tracking? And, you know,
I mean, it's actually the outcome variable, right? What are you trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think that's probably so. I think it's good to have these kind of standardization or recommendations or markers of harm. I do think the current ones I've seen are quite. I just want to use nice words. Like they're limited. Like you know, you have the UK Gambling Commission or the Dutch regulator, or you know, the EGBA coming out with their markers of harm. I haven't seen on any of them. I haven't really seen any methodology for how they've come up with these markers of harm. The KSA, I will say, they have probably the most transparent kind of documentation for how they came up with their recommendations. You know, they said they did a literature review, yeah, they engaged with some experts. So they had a little bit. They were, you know, transparent with their methodology. EGBA and the CS, is it CSE? I think the CES, the Standardization Committee. I don't know. There hasn't been anything shared in terms of how they came up with their 9 markers of harm. UK Gang.
Most like a for expert.
Expert, yeah. So yeah, I think, you know, I think they're all good efforts. I guess what I'm saying is, like, if I see any, if you go to like another domain, like, okay, if the government wants to make some recommendations on, I don't know, super palatable foods or high fatty foods, they're going to go to the evidence base. They're going to do like maybe a meta-analysis or a systematic review to try and understand, you know, what the evidence says and have that inform their recommendations. I'm being a bit self, you know, promoting here, but you know, this is what we did for the markers of harm recently for Massachusetts. So we looked at all of the evidence, we collected all of the markers of harm, and we tried to be systematic and more evidence-based about it to provide recommendations on what markers of harm should be tracked. So we looked at, for each marker of harm, we looked at, okay, how many academic papers have studied this marker of harm? So that was one metric. We said, okay, this is how many papers have looked at the marker. Then what we did as a secondary thing was evaluate the quality of those papers. So, you know, say like a number of deposits, maybe there's like 20 papers that have looked at number of deposits and put that in their algorithms, but they're all the papers are crap. You know, they didn't sufficiently report their methods. You know, they didn't say how they did hyperparameter tuning. They didn't say how they selected an algorithm. They only reported accuracy. They didn't report like area under the curve or sensitivity, specificity, whatever it might be. So that's something we did for Massachusetts. So that's on markers of harm. And then moving towards like what you're saying about outcome, right? I think it's going to be very hard to like definitively decide on what the like ground truth or like the gold standard outcome is. You know, people will probably say PGSI is best. I'd probably be fine with that. But, you know,
no, I would say, any you know, self-reported problem gambling scale, right? Because what has to be excluded are all of these, you know, self-exclusion predictions, because I mean, they predict a totally different metric. Self-exclusion doesn't, you know, I mean, there is an overlap between problem gambling, but there are also lots of areas which do not overlap. And then there are just like, you know, there are maybe 5 academic studies or maximum 6, Finkenworth, Merge, 3 of mine. Then the French did something with the Achelle data that have actually used any, you know, self-reported problem gambling scale from real world players. So that the body of,
yeah, there's not many.
Really, I mean, it's, let's say if we, you know, invested a week, maybe we find 8, you know what I mean?
Payers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's like, yeah, there isn't many that have used like a self-reported measure. And then, yeah, to your point, yeah, there's other proxy variables like, you know, account closure, self-exclusion. Yeah, I think that's how we rated the markers of harm. And in our paper, right, we looked at, okay, these markers of harm have been looked at. These ones have been used in models where the outcome variable has been PGSI or BBGS, whatever it is. And then there's these other ones, while they've been studied a lot, they haven't had a validated instrument used as an outcome variable. So those got scored lower. So we came up with this like kind of scoring rubric for different markers of harm. So it's a self plug, but like if people want to check that out, we have it published. I think it's on the Massachusetts website. But I, you know, I don't think, I think the outcome variable, you know, that what you're predicting, it is a challenge, but I think it's more about just being transparent in terms of the limitations of each one, you know, not over promising in terms of what self-exclusion does. I think self-exclusion is a good outcome, is a good proxy. And if you've got it, then I think you can probably build quite powerful models with it. Just don't be incorrect in terms of what you're predicting. Don't say you're predicting problem gambling, because you're not, are you? You're predicting something else.
I mean, so, yeah. The other, then it comes down to the detail, right? So let's say somebody builds an algorithm based on, you know, last 12 month behavior, okay? This algorithm will have, will perform very well, because what's going to happen is there's going to be lots of inactive players who are going to score low. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You're lying to yourself, basically, because in reality, that won't help you, because you will never score an inactive player, right? You know, an operator's IT department will never look into a player which gambled 8 months ago, right? That doesn't make sense. They will look into a player who gambled today, or, you know, maximum last 7 days. But if I build an algorithm on last 12 months of behavior, then all of those who didn't gamble will have a low PGSI, because they are inactive, and the model will look extremely well,
right?
Because you classify a lot of players
correctly. Especially if you just like select some specific reporting metrics, right? You could like leave out like some other ones, and it could look really good. But yeah, this is the problem. It's like the markers are.
How do you do it then? You know, or for example, somebody tosses chasing losses into the room. I mean, what's chasing losses?
How do
I assess it?
Because this is so there's the markers of harm, which is challenging. And then I think, you know, you brought up Spain, who are like recommending the use of their own algorithm, right? And I don't, it's interesting, because I don't know, how is that going to work? How did they train that model? Was it on 12 months of data? How is an operator supposed to, is it going to be like on a monthly, do they ingest monthly data and then just put it into, it's interesting. So I think, bringing it to the paper we just wrote. So we wrote this paper, I think it's called The Need for Benchmarks in AI-Enabled Player Risk Detection. So we acknowledged all of these challenges, you know, we've just been speaking about, and been like, okay, how could we actually come up with a framework that could, and, you know, it was a conceptual paper, so it's a discussion starter. So we wanted to just be like, okay, is there something we can do to kind of like move this domain forward, this AI-enabled player risk detection system? And we largely drew from what we're seeing in large language models and kind of big AI. So in that space, you know, the GPT series, you know, Gemini, OpenAI, Anthropic, what you're seeing in that space is a real movement towards benchmarking. And I'm going to describe this just a little bit. So every week, almost, these frontier labs, as you call them. So the frontier labs are the big ones like Google, OpenAI, Anthropic. There's some other ones as well, like I guess XAI, you know, Elon Musk company is a frontier lab. You've got DeepSeek in China. Alibaba is actually doing some really good work as well. But anyway, there's a lot of these different labs, and they're all producing these fantastic large language models. And every time one gets released, there's a whole host of different benchmark data sets that they can evaluate their large language models on. And these benchmark data sets evaluate a whole host of different things. There's one on math, there's one on science, there's one on reasoning capabilities. There's even ones now that are evaluating language models' abilities on kind of real world tasks. There's one called vending bench, which is the ability for a language model to operate a vending machine business. The OpenAI just released a benchmark called GDPVAL, which is a series of real world tasks that are supposed to evaluate language models' ability to, you know, replace human workers in various different spaces. So this is benchmarking, and what it allows you to do is objectively track how models perform against each other, and also how they perform over time, and their standardized benchmarks. So we wanted to understand if we could implement some kind of benchmarking framework for algorithmic risk detection. Can you come up with a series of standardized benchmarks that would enable, you know, the commercial solutions, the solutions in Spain, they could all be tested on kind of standardized frameworks. So we could begin to understand how these models should be built. And I think it will help drive innovation in the sector and actually make these models more useful. Because at the moment, there's very little kind of transparency and understanding about how effective they are. I don't think we really know.
I tell you, I mean, like, what's the issue here? The issue here is that in our case, we're talking about psychology, right? If I want to develop a model which detects a car, or I don't know, a biomarker or a disease, I have objective data, right? I mean, it all comes down to good quality training data.
Yeah.
These training data are not available, but because in order to have the training data, they have to be pre-labeled, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a way to collect the outcome variable in a large sample of randomly selected players. And nobody's doing that because the operators would have to go out there basically and constantly collect that information. And that information is psychological.
Yeah, you make a really good point in that, you know, the reason why this maybe benchmarking works really well in computer science and AI is because you do have ground truth. But, you know, part of the reason you've probably seen such amazing advancements in language, in computer vision, you know, in audio, multimodal models is because you have ground truth labeled data sets that can help advance the sector. So it is a challenge, I think, in risk detection, but you do have labels, right? We could do PGSI, BBGS, self-exclusion. You have to collect it.
That's the correct issue. Nobody does it, right? I mean, if you ask them to do it, they ask you, are you nuts? You know what I mean? I mean, what I in the past did, or, you know, partly now that some of the operators, I made them do it, you know, constantly. They didn't even have an idea what they are doing, but, you know, I use these data to come up to train the algorithms to get an idea. And I mean, there's also, and let's be honest, right? There's also a caveat to that, because if you look at all of the papers which have assessed PGSI, merge with Canadian data, I did it with UK data, German data, whatever, the others, they all come actually to a percentage of problem gamblers among the active players, whatever they are, right? You know, we discussed this before, last 12 months, last week, etc., of around 20%. I mean, nobody wants to hear that, you know, because everybody has this idea. We discussed it with Sally. 1% of the population have a problem with gambling. Yeah, but, you know, among all of the population. But if we narrow this down to the actual gamblers, and maybe narrow it even down to the actual online slot players, you know, then we come up with a very, very, very different number. Because every fifth online slot player will score 8+, and this indicates problem gambling. And whatever this means, it's again psychological, you know. Whatever I want to do with this information, if I assess harm, another metric will come out, you know. However strict, you know, my questionnaire, my screening instrument is going to be. Like, we saw this in the UK, you know, when they switched from one PGSI to the other one, suddenly, you know, doubled amount of problem gamblers. But, you know, it's psychology, you know, and it changes over time. In 10 years, maybe there is no PGSI, but there's another questionnaire, and everything will be different.
I think it's going to be a challenge. I think, you know, I do think it's possible to create labeled data sets. It would be work. You know, there's other avenues as well, right? Maybe you don't do PGSI or self-exclusion. Maybe you can kind of do some kind of hand labeling, like, you know, because you might know kind of the behaviors you're looking for. So maybe you could kind of come up with some heuristics to self-label the data set in some way. Another thing we're exploring right now is the use of synthetic data, or even, you know, developing AI agents that actually create the gambling data. So that's something we're exploring as well, as, you know, different avenues.
On the other hand, you know, let's say, you know, if you look at it from another angle, you know, let's say from the marketing angle, then it's easy, right? I'm interested in who's gonna take up this new slot machine. Bam. I make a prediction model, right? Now, what's happening in marketing, right? You just look at all sorts of favorable behavior, okay? The guy is going to play longer. The guy is going to deposit more. The guy is going to deposit when I nudge him. And I built, you know, a model for all of these different behaviors. It's very easy, you know, because whatever, you know, generates more revenue, I'm going to build a model and it's going to help me to target those who I believe are going to play more, you know, when they receive this information. And there is, in my opinion, the real value also from an achieve point of view, because what can I actually do with AI, right? I can message players randomly, like Google does it, you know, Instagram, whatever. I just try, you know. I know, you know, John likes, you know, this type of, you know, ad. But how do I learn about that? You know, I bombard John with different ads. Then I see he picks up on this one, right? You know, so I'm going to go into that direction. Kaz picks up on this one, go in this direction. And I can do that in RG too, right? You know, I send somebody, I mean, I nudge a player to whatever, change a limit after they have lost a larger amount. The player doesn't, you know, do it, doesn't follow recommendation. I nudge him again after he won. Okay, he sets the limit, he changes the limit. So I learn, okay, you know, this guy, I'm going to nudge him after a winning. Another guy, I'm nudging after a big loss. Another guy I see is not sensitive to any type of communication. Okay, I leave him be, you know. So this way I can learn how, you know, at which point of time, with which message am I going to, you know, change behavior favorable, you know, from an Archie point of view. And in my opinion, here is the real value. Okay, you know, and here you can really assist the entire player base. And of course, you know, the companies, I mean, we know, I mean, there are a few out there which focus on, you know, AI in marketing and online gambling. I mean, that's what they basically do. You know, they have different target variables for different, you know, commercially favorable behavior. And you could basically more or less reverse this and train the same, you know, same methods and have it running in the background, right? You have messages and those messages are not random, but they are placed based on, you know, the algorithm.
Yeah.
And here I don't need to collect PGSI, whatever, target variable. I mean, this entire discussion actually evaporates because I'm looking at, you know, different behavioral changes that I want to achieve, and I try to find, you know, the right point of time, the right message for the right player.
I guess it's while the marketing has the objective function of increasing revenue per player, so they have that objective function, increasing revenue per player. What would be the objective function for RG?
Yeah, maybe increasing lifetime while also, you know,
it would require more thought, but yeah, I like the concept.
I've been sitting here thinking about something while you guys have been having your highbrow conversation. And it dawned on me that chasing losses as a marker of harm is a really interesting one, because it can't be applied to lottery players.
Classic, traditional lottery, yeah.
Yeah, which I know it isn't something that attracts problem gambling anyway, because the event frequency is all out. But it just amuses me no end that there's really, you know, one or two winners.
Yeah.
And everybody else is chasing losses.
Yeah. But first time. Bringing up chasing losses, though, that's like Michael's done work in terms of how do you operationalize chasing losses with behavioral data. And that, you know, that's something where you could label a data set, right? With your operationalization of loss chasing, you could have this labeled data set of loss chasing. So that's something where, you know, maybe there's not as heavy a lift in terms of trying to create a labeled data set. And that could be a benchmark then, right? You could be like, okay, who can create the best algorithm for detecting loss chasing?
Yeah. I mean, it also comes down, like, really, you know, to the features that you produce, right? Because, yep. For example, in this Spanish algorithm, I mean, you have like 80 or something variables, but like the daily trend, I mean, like really complicated ones, you know?
I think all of that, yeah, I think, you know, this is a bit, this is me looking into the future, but I think feature engineering is actually just going to become obsolete soon, because I think it's all going to be automated. Like, I know the first iteration of what we called auto ML or automated machine learning, it didn't really deliver on the promise of being automated. But I think there's going to be kind of a second generation of automated machine learning where the entire machine learning and algorithm generation pipeline is just all automated. Your feature engineering is going to be automated. Your algorithm selection is going to be automated. Implementation is going to be automated.
I totally agree with you. No, I mean, for example, okay, you drive whatever, you know, a modern car, and it detects other cars, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't care how it does it, right? I mean,
exactly.
You don't go and, you know, call Elon Musk and ask him, hey, you know, can you?
Yes. Tell me the features. Yeah. But,
you know, one issue, yeah. You know, that we have, you know, working with the operators is really, you know, explainability. So
Look,
so you mentioned before the Netherlands, okay? So they ask for, okay, how do you do that? You know, how do you detect problematic gambling? Okay, if you really used an advanced algorithm, you couldn't tell, right? I mean, even if you use a random forest algorithm, you can't tell, because it produces hundreds of trees, and then you know, it goes through them, averages, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Or you compute, you know, let's say you say, okay, there's the logarithm of the average amount bet over the last 30 days multiplied by the age, etc. And then they keep asking you, yeah, but when is somebody a high-risk player? How much do they have to spend? Okay? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's not one variable. And the issue is that the human brain cannot think multidimensional, right? We cannot, you know, sort of think in a way, okay, if this happens and that happens, and maybe it's nonlinear, right? You know, you can't think in two dimensions. For us, it's basically, okay, males are, good example is, okay, the score is higher for males than females. However, okay, you know, if the person plays at night, it's different, okay? Or if they play on an iOS, it's different than on an Android. But then, hold on, okay, you said males, you know, are more risky than females. Yeah, but not, you know, not when you take into account other variables. That's completely confusing. I mean, we as statisticians who are used to applying these models, we just accept it, right? We accept, look, the algorithm does what it does. It detects the car, it detects this, it detects that. But they all demand explainability. UK, right. For example. In the UK, there is an audit. Okay, so an operator is audited. How does that work? A person complains to the UKGC, or players, right? They collect this. Okay, then they go to operator A and say, okay, pull up this person, right? Show me what you did. They pull up the person. Then they tell them, okay, the guy was high risk there, or was not high risk, we didn't do anything. Yeah, but why, you know? The guy lost 200 pounds. What did you do? When did you do it? How did you monitor it, etc.? So
are they asking, though, like, how, I mean, so to those questions you just said, though, that's like, okay, you identify this player at risk. What did you do? Are they asking, how did your system classify that player as a risk?
Absolutely. Yeah. First of all, classify. Okay. And it has to be basically, they have to explain it based on the specific criteria.
Yeah. So that's an issue. That's an issue, because that's gonna hinder progress, right? Because
the algorithm and, you know, an algorithm and explainability are two, you know, how do you say?
Yeah, no, I like your opposing forces. Yeah, forces. Yeah. Yeah, I like your analogy of self-driving cars, because if you had a regulator demanding everything and anything about how, you know, the cameras on self-driving cars do things, you would probably have really crappy self-driving cars, wouldn't you? So
yeah, because they don't care, because it works. And the issue is, again, I'm coming back to the gambling, there is no fucking outcome variable, you know? But I mean, if we'd agree, this is what we want to achieve, okay? This is my algorithm, perfect, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's maybe it's just like, maybe the outcome variable is fines by the regulator. So if you just minimize the fines by the regulator.
The US didn't fine anybody, right?
Yeah.
Two fines last year. For online gambling operators, the UK, you know, fine. So and again, you know, another issue that you have is the environment. So let's say, I would say, if I am an individual and, you know, I want to be as free as possible with respect to my gambling, I go play in the US. Okay, I can do whatever I want. I can lose whatever I want. Nobody's going to bother me, probably. If I want to be restricted as much as possible, I go to Germany. So your algorithm, you know, that you train on the US data will not work on your German data, not because behavior is different, the psychology is different, because the players are different, because they are so limited, you know. If you train an algorithm in the US on amount bet, average amount bet, you know, on all of those absolute metrics, it's not going to work, because nobody's going to, you know, delve into that realm in Germany, right?
Sure.
Your algorithm, we're never gonna see these extreme data points.
Yeah, it's gonna be out of distribution. Yeah, you probably never have kind of like a general risk detection.
If you come up with a framework, all of the metrics, the features have to be relative.
Mm-hmm.
None of them can be absolute. You know, it's gotta be okay. How often did the guy deposit an average in a session? On how many days did the guy gamble? What percentage of gambling is happening during the nighttime? How many different games does this guy play? But as soon as you bring in the amount bet, the amount deposited, your algorithm will be valid in one location. If they make a change to the regulation, it's gonna, you know, go to a waste basket. So it all has to be relative.
I agree. I'll big up a student here. She's about to start her master's in computer science. She'll be presenting at the conference actually in May. That she's come up with a really cool kind of risk detection system that doesn't rely on these features actually. You're just looking at individual player behavior.
Yeah, I like that, yeah. Mm.
So you're not engineering these aggregated features or anything. You're kind of, it kind of borrows from what the language models do in terms of like understanding just sequences of text. You're just looking at sequences of player behavior instead, and just deciding based on the sequence and the time series, then you're just doing it based on that rather than actual features.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah.
Jonathan, what do you think about all of that?
Yeah. To be quite deep, but yeah.
I think this has gone so far over my head. It feels almost like the hair that I no longer have. It's been really, really interesting. And you kind of wish we could just, you know, go on for a lot longer. I think it'd be very nice, Kezra, if you came back on. Because I think there's an awful lot of things that we've touched on here that, do you know what I mean? It's, the thing about this space, and Kezra, you're obviously going to know this very, very well, is that the research is constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And new perspectives are coming into it, and they're very often coming from a completely different standpoint. I think one of the interesting things about RG, and one of the less appealing things about RG, is that people are looking at it and think, hey, we can make some money over there. Yay. Because nothing's ever gone bad with the introduction of money. But
well, that's another issue that I think, just to touch on the commercialization, I guess, and go back to the benchmarking framework we proposed. I think, you know, because RG detection, at least AI systems for RG detection, you know, the way it is currently, it incentivizes these players to compete on price, on marketing, on how easily the systems can be implemented into an operator. So you know, it's creating this competitive landscape that isn't based on how good these systems are. It's based on, as I said, how much does it cost? How easy is it for me to implement? And how good is your sales team? Which is what these things shouldn't be being evaluated on. So.
Yeah, and you know, you've got two sides of a coin here, and they're unfortunately both painted in shit, because you've either got the solely commercial way of doing it or the mandated way of doing it, and they're both crap.
Well, I think so. That's why I think the benchmarking is quite powerful, because it kind of sits there as this framework to incentivize based on innovation.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the US is screaming out for a standardized framework, even if it is just in data reporting, or, you know, I think you mentioned, I think before we started recording, Kasra, you were listening to the episode with Vasiliki from the EGBA, and I knew, I'd read about what they've been doing, but listening to Vasiliki talk about it, I was just sitting there thinking, why didn't anybody do this sooner? It's so simple.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think we talked about it earlier. I think, I don't know how useful it is. That might be a bit harsh, but I just don't know.
Think of it in another way. Don't think of it as an academic. Think of it as non-academic. Think of it so that people like me have standardized terminology. So when we're talking about something, we're talking about the same thing.
It's a first step, basically, right?
Yeah, but for outside of research and outside of academia, it's actually a really important first step. Mm. And for governments and regulatory bodies, it's also an important step, I think, potentially. Sorry,
Mike. Let's continue this next week. You're in Barcelona, aren't you, Cas?
Yeah, I'll be in Barcelona, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, but this episode's going to come out about 3 weeks after Barcelona, yeah. Michael. Okay, yeah. And I'm leaving this part in just so you look foolish.
But then, you know, I'm advertise the Las Vegas conference a little bit.
I'd love to do that, actually. I should have done this earlier, because I don't know how many people will be still here, but
yeah, that's a good point.
So the conference is May 26th to 28th here in beautiful Las Vegas. We're actually holding it at the Bellagio this year, which is going to be awesome, I think. We typically get around 500 attendees, a really good mix of academics, regulators, policymakers, industry, treatment providers, lawyers. So we get a whole mix of people. You know, I know this podcast is about RG addiction. We definitely have a good amount of content around responsible gambling, problem gambling, but we really get some interesting content around game math, marketing, business operations, perspectives on legal developments in tribes. I'm sure we're going to have some stuff on prediction markets this year. So just a really good mix of content. We have keynotes and panel sessions as well. Have a nice social on the second night. So I don't know. I think it's a really good conference. It only happens every 3 years. I think it's one to come to. If you like gambling conferences and you know, if you want to learn, if you want to mingle with like the who's who of academia, but also like industry people as well, I think it's a really good conference.
Interestingly, while we were recording, Michael, I've got confirmation that we will probably be there.
Wow.
I know, right?
So you approve me or?
Oh, no, I can't get you into the US. Only God can do that, Michael.
I don't share a room with you, okay?
Oh, God, no.
Bunk beds.
Austrians are famed for their farting.
I gotta get to the chopper.
Yeah.
Not much for me.
Get to the chopper. Kasra, thank you so much. Anybody looking for information on the UNLV International Gaming Institute conference, where can they find more information about that?
Yeah, if you go to unlv.edu/IGI, I believe that's our page. Hopefully I'm getting that correct, but there should be some links to the conference there. Also, you know, if you follow me on LinkedIn, I'll be posting a lot about it. So please follow me on LinkedIn. Abstracts, if you want to submit for a presentation, I think the deadline is January 23rd. So that's, I think we're going to be releasing this podcast after that date. But
Yeah, maybe. So if you got any good ideas for it, you might want to think about how it might look in a few years.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, maybe if there's space, you can still DM me and if we can squeeze you in.
Now there's an offer.
I shouldn't have said that.
You're going to be deluged. You could have 5-6 messages. No, I'm just kidding. Dr. Auer, are you going to thank the good doctor for joining us?
Absolutely. Thank you, Kasra.
No, thanks for having me. I know we got a bit deep there. I'm happy to come again and talk about some other stuff as well.
But yeah. That's the point of this podcast is a holistic view of addiction, not just gambling addiction, but also to get nerdy.
Interesting. Good.
So this is perfect. Thank you very, very much.
This episode of Addiction and Hour with Hour is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit gaminglabs.com.